Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Back in 2021, former NATO Allied Supreme Commander Admiral James Dragaitis and his co-author, Marine veteran and author Elliot Ackerman, came on The Realignment to discuss their new book, 2034. 2034 was all about the consequences of an escalating conflict between the U.S. and China. 2034 is a part of a broader trilogy the two of them are writing about the existential crises facing the world in the 21st century. Now they are out with the second part of their trilogy, 2054, which is all about artificial intelligence, synthetic biology, and the emerging threats to the political system that could come out of a failure to handle these technological developments. As they discussed during the conversation, these books should be understood not as predictions about the future, but as frameworks for understanding how things could go wrong if policymakers, people in the business community, and technologists don't take the right approaches to these new developments. I really enjoyed this conversation, and of course, I'm looking forward to the third part of their trilogy. Hope you all enjoy the conversation. A huge thank you to the Foundation for American Innovation for supporting the work of this podcast. Admiral James Dragaitis and Elliot Ackerman, welcome back to The Realignment.
Good to be with you, Marshall.
Thanks for having us.
So listeners will know that I'm a huge fan of Elliot. I've had him on for all of your recent books, including 2034. And Admiral, we obviously really enjoyed speaking with you about 2034. We recorded two different conversations with the both of you. So I'm glad that for 2054, we can merge everything together here. So let's start here. Having read both books, I think folks who aren't thinking editorially about your work are kind of wonder, okay, the first book is about China and the US, and all of a sudden we're shifting over to biology, AI, American politics. That just seems like such a big shift. What's going on there? My interpretation of your work is that you're using this trilogy as a means of exploring the grand narratives that are going to define the 21st century. So obviously a U.S.-China conflict is one of the most immediate potential crises facing ourselves as a country and a world. But if we were to look further into the century, these questions of AI, the political system, science are going to matter just as much. Is that a proper interpretation of how you two are approaching this project?
Yes, it is. We started out fundamentally with the idea of a three-book trilogy. And the idea was to investigate three big, distinct potential crises that could occur in this century. We put them in this particular order because that strikes us as the order in which they could come. But who knows? We started with conflict between U.S. and China. As you correctly point out, this one, 2054, adds artificial intelligence and civil conflict in America. And 2084 will be the third book in the series, the furthest out. That deals with the geopolitical impact of climate change. So all three of them function as cautionary tales about big issues in this century.
Now, Elliot, something I'm curious about as a fiction writer yourself, if one could look back at the 20th century, one could say that the really, and I'd love to hear your two takes on this, but I would say some of the defining experiences are obviously the two world wars, the end of colonialism and the transition to a broader geopolitical sphere. You have obviously the issues of the splitting of the atom. You have the internet. To what degree can one sitting in the year 1920 or sitting in the year 2024 have confidence that one can actually select the proper trends that could define things?
I think if you were sitting in 1924, it would not be impossible to have predicted some of those macro trends. I think scientifically, work around the atom was far enough along that it could be extrapolated out that an atom could have been used for nuclear warfare. I think one could probably has also done the work to understand how nuclear weapons could potentially become a deterrent. I think we'd already seen sort of the end of colonialism, and we'd already experienced one world war, and the idea of a second was at that point percolating. So, difficult to do, not impossible. But I think it's also, just important for the two of us to say, these books are not necessarily intended to be works of prediction. They're intended to be works of speculation, almost inoculations, if you will. said, if we imagine the bad thing, the act of imagining it makes us less susceptible to sort of catching the fever of calamity and experiencing the worlds and the end games that we have imagined in these books thus far. But, you know, listen, we've had a lot of fun with these books. And I think even if when we're sitting in 1924 trying to predict out, you know, the pretty grim 20th century, you know, you might have had a lot of fun trying to do that as well.
One I would add is just if you're in the 1920s, I think you probably could see the edges of the rise of fascism. I think you could probably perceive that these colonial empires were under great stress. The technology, as Eliot says, so far beyond what you could imagine. And that is a real lesson to us. Final thought, what I always think of the 20th century in many ways is also about the rise of women, about sociology and bringing women into the vote, into national. By the end of the century, you have women leading big countries, Margaret Thatcher, most famously, but many others. That would have been very difficult to predict as well.
Yeah, it's so interesting because if you just, as I'm hearing you two speak out loud, I'm thinking, okay, so in, you know, World War One, you had the Germans use, you know, Zeppelins in limited context to drop bombs on London. It's not determinative of the war, obviously, but that's the type of trend you could extrapolate. Around 1925, like Billy Mitchell proves that you could actually sink capital ships via an airplane. That's very controversial at the time, but that has real implications for World War II. So it just really is interesting that is as much as you, with, if, as long as you're not overly prescriptive, you can look at trends and you can look at technology. Sociology is a little harder. It'd be so hard to look at, you know, the women getting the right to vote and then extrapolate what that means for the 1980s or the 1990s. But if you're looking at technology, you could actually, I think, maybe suss out certain threads that matter. So let's start there. What between us, starting with you, Admiral, what are the technological trends or developments that you are focusing on and pulling the threads of?
Yeah, number one for me is what has been called the singularity. I certainly didn't invent that term, neither did Eliot. This comes from a futurist, Ray Kurzweil, who wrote a book called The Singularity is Near. And what he's talking about, Marshall, is the merge of biology, cyber, materials, artificial intelligence, broadly conceived, bringing all that together so that the human mind ultimately can be imprinted on a chip. That, I think, is the number one thing I'm focused on right now. And just in the last month, we've all heard about Elon Musk and the insertion of chips into our brains. I think by mid-century, there'll be dramatic advancements here. So top of my list is that merge of biology, cyber, artificial intelligence, to some degree materials involving the chip and how it goes into the human body. All that, I think, is moving maybe faster than 2054.
How about you, Eliot?
Yeah, I'd add, and I think one of the things you see in the book is there are kind of corollaries when we look into our history. So one of the themes that comes up in 2030 or in 2054 is that we see not an arms race, but a technology race, in so much as the great power competition is no longer military. It's technological, with various world powers and various entities, even the US government, knowing that whoever reaches these technological breakthroughs first, with advances in quantum computing and otherwise, we'll be able to innovate at a pace so much further beyond their competitors that once you get there first, you in effect win. And so that type of technological race that is from sociologically kind of mirrors the arms races that we saw in the 20th century. So I think when you look at a book of 2054, yes, it is a book steeped in technology, but it's also a book that I think is deeply anchored in the types of political conflicts that have been existing since the dawn of mankind. And I think, as you know, it's a book that starts with a political assassination of a US president. And that's a story as old as Julius Caesar. But in 2054, you know, it's not a dagger that gets stabbed into the president. It's a line of code, but a political assassination nonetheless.
Something that's interesting here, you just spoke about this when you spoke about the technological competition. defining feature of basically the 1500s onwards, Treaty of Westphalia, all those fun AP US history facts, the nation state. And critically, when we're talking about technological competition, you're bringing up Ewan Musk makes this relevant, Admiral. It's not merely states that are competing and are developing technology. It's actually corporations and its labs, its individuals. You know, Kurzweil is a character in the book. He's operating as an individual separate from just a big multinational company. I'd love to hear the two of you talk about how you think through the role of the individual, corporations, nation states, flitting together, sometimes incompatible, sometimes compatible. How do you think through that?
Well, all great fiction is great characters. And the story both of 2034 and 2054 is carried by humans and by, I think, really interesting spread of characters from kind of a young entrepreneur from Africa to a scientist locked up in his lab to a pair of young women, one in private equity, the other one in the U.S. military. So there's this spread of characters. So point one, all great fiction, I think, is carried by great characters. And I hope these characters will be interesting to people and help propel the story. In terms of nation states and corporations, you've got it exactly right, Marshall. We're seeing the rise of non-state actors. We tend to think about that from this moment in the century, with terrorist groups. We've just gone through 20 years of war with non-state actors, but this is a completely different line of effort by these big multinational corporations, who I think by mid-century will have a lot to say about the global economy, technology, and geopolitics itself. That's part of the fabric of 2054.
Yeah, and I would just say we're already seeing it, Marshall. You know, I also work as a journalist, and I was in Ukraine last week. And you cross over the border from Poland into Ukraine. And if you're in an area where there's spotty cell service, never fear, because you can just go into your settings and pull up the Starlink app and get online that way. And so we've seen, you know, the power that, as Jim noted, not terrorists, non-state actors, but just corporate actors can have in putting their fingers on the scales in really profound ways. And that's a trend that we extrapolate forward into 2054 as the United States is thrust into a civil conflict. But you have some of these individuals, these non-state actors, who are playing really determinative roles in that conflict.
And now, a quick word about the A16C podcast. Hey, it's Marshall. In an exponential era, it's more important than ever for our country to have alignment between policymakers, founders, and funders. However, it's rare that we find all of them in the same room. Luckily, the A16Z podcast from Andreessen Horowitz just dropped a brand new series on American dynamism focused on exactly this. Coined by Realignment friend and A16Z general partner Catherine Boyle, American dynamism is a movement that embodies the spirit of innovation, and this new four-part series, recorded in the heart of Washington, D.C., covers topics including intelligence in the era of AI, the nuclear renaissance, and the future of defense. Guests include the CIA's first ever Chief Technology Officer, Nand Mulchandani, the Department of Energy's Assistant Secretary for Nuclear Energy, Dr. Catherine Huff, and Director of the DoD's Defense Innovation Unit, Doug Beck. Not to mention the founders of ambitious companies rivaling the status quo, like microreactor company Radiant, AI pilot company Shield AI, and advanced autonomous systems company Anduril. So don't miss out. Go check out the A16Z podcast and their new series on American dynamism on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening now. You know, something I'm really curious about, speaking of characters, is this idea of to what degree does technology and technology relationship to biology change human nature and how we expect people to operate. So I personally, you can see this from all the books on my bookshelf, I take a lot of solace in history. If I'm thinking through the war in Ukraine, I'm thinking about World War I, I'm thinking about World War II, you're thinking about the Cold War. We can use these examples and these stories as, I think, frankly, it's somewhat reassuring. People have been through challenges that were as bad or worse than ours and you could get there. But to what degree would technology changing our biology, changing how long we could live, kind of really prevent history from serving as a model or a way of interpreting what will come next? I'm curious how you think about that.
Well, we've been through these kind of pivotal moments before, I think. And what has, in my view, what has emerged is that at least thus far, no matter how profound the technological shift, human nature remains roughly what it has been. Humans are ambitious. They want power. They want control. I'm watching a fantastic new miniseries right now on Hulu, Shogun. It's a remake of Japan in the 1600s and the infighting between the clans. You could drop a plumb line from that to the Republican Party today. And again and again, human history tends to overcome these technological shifts. And so even something as profound as this merge, this singularity, I think we're still going to find, and I love when Eliot brings up Julius Caesar, you'll find great ambition and forces that rise up against great ambition. That's a story that has unfolded again and again. Eliot?
You know, I'm someone like you, Marshall, who's like very much, you know, you look at my bookshelves, like I'm steeped in history, and I take a lot of solace in reading history, and history often helps me frame my consciousness in terms of how I'm thinking about current events. And I think as much as humanity and human nature is a constant throughout the story of our species, our consciousness can change, particularly our collective consciousness. And I think that's something all of us have experienced, you know, whether it's through, you know, these phones and how they can sort of warp our perceptions of reality, or, you know, our 24/7 cable news cycle, how it can kind of sort of incite us to rage. Human consciousness has evolved. And, you know, the way we live and interact with each other today is not the same as it was 250 years ago, or even 20 years ago, and has changed pretty radically. And so, like, one of the themes in the book that we do play with is this idea of, okay, how do these new technologies not necessarily change the fundamentals of human nature, but how do they start changing the fundamentals of human consciousness, and how do various actors toy with that consciousness? You know, and that gets into sort of this discussion of the singularity, which, you know, we definitely go into in the book.
You know, Eliot, a follow-up that folks are going to be thinking about if they're watching the YouTube version of this conversation. I'm interested in how the two of you chose to depict the future. So, perfect example, if you're watching on YouTube, you could see that none of us are wearing ties. We're wearing blazers, we're wearing like button-up shirts. But after COVID, something that's clearly just happened is the tie is struggling. I love ties. It's a struggle. I think if this were in person in DC, I'd probably wear a tie. I probably wouldn't wear one in New York. But that's just an example of how, like, in a brief tiny moment, everything could shift. There's a specific scene in the book, Eliot, where you all have a person just, you know, cinch up a tie. I was just sort of thinking, I was like, oh, interesting. Like, they chose to envision a world where 30 years from now, there's just an environment where one would wear a tie. How do you, as a writer, because you can't just literally make the future look totally different. I think that'd take too much work, be somewhat arbitrary. How do you think through, extending like, from that tie example, making the future look different, but also keeping it somewhat similar to our present to keep us rooted in something?
Well, I very much believe and am an advocate for this sort of idea of the uncanny. I don't know if it's a concept you're familiar with, but the uncanny is sort of this idea that if something looks very close to reality but is a little off, that's more unsettling than if it were extremely off. Like, an example of this would be, you know, let's say, Marshall, that like you had a robot that would help you with chores around the house and make your bed and do the vacuuming for you. Like, if that robot was sort of like a cute little R2-D2 looking robot, that wouldn't seem creepy to you at all and wouldn't keep you up at night. But if that robot was sort of looked 99% just like a human being, except sort of had maybe like a little glass-eyed look every now and again it gave you, that would
be terrifying.
Very upsetting. Yeah, it's terrifying. So, like, I think Jim and I in both these books have tried to create worlds where we're leaning on the camp. The world looks different and you know it's different, but it's not so different that you can't see very heavy shades of our current world in it. And that is unsettling. So I think when it comes to, you know, little things like, you know, tying up your tie, or how people are reading the news, or, you know, getting a taxi cab or whatever, we're trying to hit that sweet spot of making the book feel uncanny to the reality that we're living in right now.
Yeah, I agree completely with that. By the way, that tie scene is, A very famous political actor is having an afternoon tryst with his mistress, and she is actually tying his tie for him. I think that tie scene is actually quite good. The point I want to make is Eliot's idea of a little bit different, just enough. It creates a real eeriness that kind of floats through the book. And two examples of that from modern literature that I really like are Ian McEwan's Machines Like Me. And another one is Kazuo Ishiguro, Nobel Prize winner. His most recent, Clara and the Sun, has elements of this. In fact, all of his books almost float like a dream. And I think that's very powerful because that's almost how we think about the future. We can't quite grab it. It's going to be kind of like what we have now, but something very different. And that those are the Easter eggs in the novel, I think.
Yeah, I think that's really well put. I'm just stuck. I'm stuck on the Uncanny Valley idea here because it really is true. If there was perfectly just extrapolated out to completely different, that'd be really, really distracting. Speaking of books, I make a habit of whenever there's an interesting book that's mentioned somewhere, I like to pick it up. And a book that plays a big role in the story is called The Nightingale's Song. I didn't know if it was real or not, but it's a real book from the 1980s. It looks super interesting. It's about Vietnam, then Naval Secretary Jim Webb, then Senator John McCain. It really is going through that period. And I like books like that because it's the definition of like a really interesting story, but it's just forgotten. There is just no way I would have ever possibly found that book. I'm curious from the two of you, especially you, Admiral, because you've written multiple books about books. What are some examples of books that listeners would, if they enjoy this book, if they enjoy The Nightingale Song recommendation, what's a book you could just think of that like there's no way someone's encountered it, but you'd recommend like looking into it because it's going to be forgotten if not for that?
I would go to the two authors I just talked about, both Ian McEwan and Kazuo Ishiguro. One novel, a very evocative title by Ishiguro, is An Artist of the Floating World. And it's set in Japan and pulls a lot of distinct threads of personality through it and out of it. In terms of Ian McEwan, the one I mentioned, Machines Like Me, these are two books, novels that were not big gargantuan bestsellers. They're perfectly crafted small novels, just beautifully wrought, both of them. And I think deserve a place on any serious reader of fiction's shelf. Eliot's probably got an idea or two.
Oh, you know, I'm always sort of, I will tell you, and this is not within our genre, although I'm big fans of those books that Jim mentioned. And I know, you know, the two of us are both big fans of A Nightingale's Song, so I'd encourage people to pick that one up. But I just finished this book, The Wizard of the Kremlin, which is was very big in France, was a finalist for the Prix Goncourt, and it's just an amazing psychological analysis of Vladimir Putin. Fictionalized, but really, I mean, like a knock your socks off good book. So I would certainly recommend that to any of your readers.
You two started the podcast by mentioning that this isn't predictive, it's examining worst case scenarios. Are the two of you optimists or pessimists when it comes to technology? This seems to be like the big defining narrative debate that we're having right now.
I'm an optimist. I'm Greek American. Greeks tend to be very optimistic by nature. I grew up in an optimistic household. I'm optimistic. And if you want examples, again, from history, think of the printing press. The printing press comes along and suddenly knowledge can be reproduced, handed out. And a lot of people, including the major religions of the time, were horrified at this idea. Yet we can't imagine a world, and we've just spent 30 minutes talking about all the wonderful books we read. Second obvious example is electricity. Again, could have been used for a terrible purpose, could have been driving military activities, and yet electricity has become fundamental to every aspect of our lives. I think this idea of artificial intelligence will ultimately fall in that category. There'll be bad things that come out of it and dangerous things, and that's what we try to illuminate in 2054, but ultimately I'm optimistic it'll be a force for good.
Yeah, I sort of agree with Jim. I'm optimistic, even though I'm certainly a person who is inclined to look on the past with rose-colored glasses and think, oh, it must have been so great back then. But even as I do so, I recognize that that's probably just its own type of delusional thinking. You know, the Woody Allen movie Midnight in Paris is one of my all-time favorites because I can certainly see myself in that. But you know, at the end of the day, it's there's this great saying about war, which is you might not be interested in war, but war is interested in you. I would just add technology to that. You might not be interested in technology, but technology is interested in you. In the world that we're going to live in, you know, we can't control how it's going to evolve, and sometimes we don't even recognize the technologies we're using every single day that are foundational. So I'm optimistic because I think we as a species have this capacity to just metabolize technology and innovation, and I think we'll continue to do so in ways that benefit all of us.
That is an excellent place to end. Admiral Elliott, thank you for coming on the show. Look forward to having you all back on for 2084, whenever that comes out.
Next time we'll wear
Marshall.
We'll do our parts yeah. there. Thanks for joining.
Thanks, Marshall. Well, great interview. Really enjoyed
thank
it.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks. Yeah. Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.